Welcome to another episode of Law Talk, a legal podcast presented by the American Constitution Society. I am Joseph Jerome, a law fellow here at ACS, and I hope you enjoy the podcast.
I for president, I for president, I for president, I for president. You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president,
hang out the banner, beat the drum, we'll take Ike to Washington.
With a presidential election season in high gear, today's discussion centers on our fundamental right to vote. After witnessing record turnout in the past two elections, we have seen unprecedented amounts of new voting restrictions, cutbacks to early voting, harsh limits on voter registration efforts, and voter purges are just some of the many restrictions being implemented in states across the country. New photo ID requirements in particular have received a lot of press coverage. Today, six states now require specific forms of photo ID to vote. Here's the debate. Proponents of these laws insist that they are necessary to combat voter fraud and ensure we have fair elections. Critics respond that these laws are completely unnecessary and simply make voting harder for already vulnerable subsets of the voting population. I decided to speak at some length with Justin Levitt, Associate Professor of Law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, to really get a handle on what's going on here. Professor Levitt is a national expert in election law. He served as National Voter Protection Counsel, he was counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, an organization that continues to put forward important studies on voting. Professor Levitt has also, I might add, recently authored an ACS issue brief, The New Wave of Election Regulation, Burden Without Benefit. And I thought he'd be the perfect person to explain what exactly is going on with all these new election regulations. So, Professor Levitt, what's the impetus behind all these new regulations?
Well, thanks very much for inviting me to speak about this, Joe, and thank you to ACS for hosting the forum. I think it's important not to paint with too broad a brush. Elections need regulations. If we didn't have regulated elections, they'd be a mess. Nobody would get to vote because it'd be complete chaos. I think the real test for any election regulation is, does it achieve what it purports to achieve? And what we've seen, unfortunately, and I think increasingly over the last year or so, are a number of regulations put forth in some rather prominent states on the national field that don't meet that very basic test, where the cost of the regulations are actually far greater than the benefits, and in fact, in some cases, are directly counterproductive.
All we hear in the media is that voter fraud is a real problem in American elections. So, are these regulations combating that? What is the state of voter fraud in America today?
So fraud does happen. Irregularities do happen. The type of misconduct that happens and the type of problems that occur aren't really being addressed by the new sweep of election laws. Instead, what states tend to have been doing is passing regulations that cut back on access to the franchise, that cut back on people's ability to vote easily, but not in a way that fixes any real substantial existing problem. So the most prominent of these are new laws restricting the ways that individuals can demonstrate that they are who they say they are at the polls. Super clear, every state requires that voters prove that they are who they say they are in lots of different ways. So the most basic is that you sign in at the polls and somebody can match that signature up to the signature on your registration card. It's the way that we prove we are who we say we are when we buy a credit card product or when we sign a contract or when we do any number of other things in normal society. That's the normal basis for proving that we are who we say we are.
Can I interrupt you for a second and just ask, as a first line matter, why can't we just expect people to present an ID to vote? You know, the quote that comes around so often, and it's from Governor Nikki Haley, just simply says, well, we require an ID to let someone buy a Sudafed, so why shouldn't we require an ID to let somebody vote?
So, first of all, as a first-line question, most of the time when people are saying that quote, they're giving examples of things like renting a hotel room or going to fly across the country, getting on an airplane, things like that. If you have to show an ID to do those things, why don't you have to show an ID to vote? And that is both wrong and irrelevant. It's wrong, and in fact, I proved this. In order to testify before Congress, I had to get on a plane in L.A. and make my way to D.C. And I did this in order to testify about the impact of specific government-issued photo ID rules without a driver's license in my wallet. And in fact, without any government-issued photo ID.
How much extra time did you have to deal? How much extra time did you have to deal with TSA?
It was an incremental hassle, but I estimate that it took all of 15 minutes extra at the airport line. It probably took all of 10 minutes extra at the hotel. It didn't take any time at all, sadly, at the restaurant where I ordered a beer. I guess they thought I was old enough not to have to card. And this wasn't, by the way, my slipping through or pulling a parlor trick. This is absolutely policy and has been for decades that photo IDs are preferred, as they're preferred in most walks of American life, because, frankly, most people have government-issued photo IDs. But for those who don't, both government and commerce finds a way to make an exception, finds a way to allow those people to get on a plane, rent a hotel room, etc. Sudafed is one of the few examples where it's still possible. It's much trickier to get a full-strength Sudafed without a government-issued photo ID. But there, my response is, so what? Nobody in the country fought and died for the right of every eligible American to take decongestants. Voting is central to our constitutional order. It appears in two articles of the original Constitution. It appears in at least 10 amendments to the Constitution. Our entire system of government and governance and lawmaking depends on the ability of eligible Americans to give their consent to the people who make the laws, and we do that by voting, by having access to the franchise. And so that is it's a constitutional promise and a constitutional right that is far more important than the ability to buy decongestants, which is nice, but not a guarantee, not a fundamental guarantee of our system. And therefore, it's really important to safeguard. Now, there are regulations that we need on that process. And if it is truly necessary to regulate, then we as a society accept some limitations on voting. But we demand a higher standard because voting is so important. And thus, when it's not truly necessary, we have to question whether incremental regulations, incremental burdens are worth the cost. These new photo ID rules, these new voter ID rules, aren't really about asking people to prove that they are who they say they are, because every state already requires that. They're about restricting the way in which you can prove that you are who you say you are to a few government-issued photo ID documents. Most people in America have those documents, but a substantial percentage and an even more substantial number just don't. If you don't have current government-issued photo ID, it can be awfully difficult to get current government-issued photo ID. So I use Arkansas as an example only because, when doing the research, it's one of the states that crops up first in the alphabetical order. But in Arkansas, you need a birth certificate, an official copy of your birth certificate, in order to get a government-issued photo ID. But if you don't happen to have an official copy of your birth certificate, then in order to get that birth certificate, you need government-issued photo ID. So you need a birth certificate to get ID, but you need ID to get a birth certificate. And that's the catch-22 that people are talking about. It can be difficult. It can also be difficult because we take for granted often that the access that we have is access that everyone has. Not everybody was born in a hospital, and I promise you, nobody came out of the womb bearing identity papers. There are people in America who manage to navigate society, and for them it is unquestionably more difficult, but they're still eligible voting age citizens, and they manage to navigate without a photo ID. We need to be conscious in designing our regulations about them as well.
I also was wondering if you could maybe address the argument that voter IDs actually increase turnout. Proponents have cited 2008 as an example where we saw increased voter turnout across the board, and we also saw some of these voter ID laws go into effect. So what does the data say on this?
So What we know from the data is that we don't know anything.
All right.
And that's super important to remember. So first of all, I think turnout is the wrong measure.
Okay.
So when people say what's the impact of rules like strict voter ID, turnout's the wrong measure because that affects eligible Americans who haven't decided to be in the process yet. And I am still very hopeful that we can get these eligible Americans involved. But about a third of the country is not yet registered to vote. And that's a third of eligible American citizens not yet registered to vote. I think that every time you put up a barrier in the form of a regulation, the impact on those individuals has to be accounted for in deciding whether the barrier is worth it or not, or whether it's constitutional or not. And turnout simply doesn't measure that. It's the tool that we have. It's the tool that political scientists like to use, but it doesn't measure the impact on people who didn't vote last time. And just as a mental experiment to see this, if you made a rule right now that said nobody who didn't vote in 2008, if you didn't vote in 2008, you are no longer eligible to vote, there'd be an extremely...
So that's 40% of the population.
Yeah, but there'd be an extremely minor effect on turnout, right? In 2012... you'd see, based on some people who have passed away since 2008, based on a few people who just decide not to vote, you'd see minor fluctuations in turnout from 2008 to 2012. But you'd lock out 40% of the population instantly. Nobody thinks that's a good idea. That's what turnout effects don't tell you. So for one, I think turnout's the wrong measure. Even if it were the right measure, though, and it's guaranteed to be the measure that's talked about often because, like I say, it's the data we've got, there simply isn't enough turnout data to know anything, really, about the effect of strict photo ID rules. So I mentioned minority of states have rules that say you cannot vote a valid ballot if you do not have a government-issued photo ID. In 2008, Georgia and Indiana were the only two states with that law. So if you're measuring turnout differences based on photo ID laws, you've only got two data points, and that is the turnout in Georgia and Indiana in 2004 or 2000 and 2008. Now, trying to disaggregate the effect of photo ID rules from two data points is impossible. But even if... So now we're getting into the third even if you don't buy my argument that turnout's not the right measure, and even if you think we've got enough data, using the 2008 turnout in Indiana and Georgia to say that voter ID increased turnout, particularly among minorities, is ludicrous. It is an argument that fails statistics 101, because in 2008, Indiana and Georgia were battleground states that hadn't been for a very long time, with a minority candidate at the head of a national party's nomination slate. 2008 was a tidal wave of turnout and was always going to be a tidal wave of turnout. And so we simply can't tell the effect of those photo ID rules on the tidal wave of turnout. Maybe the wave would have been higher. Maybe the wave would have been a whole lot less high. But we have no way of knowing. How do we know what the effect is? Well, you ask people. So there have been a number of surveys done asking people, do you have an ID? Do you have the right kind of ID? Is that ID current? Does the name on your ID match the name in the registration rolls? Asking people successive questions like that. And unsurprisingly, there's some variation in what the surveys report. Even if you take the very lowest number, and the very lowest number came out of an American University survey, said that about 1.2% of the registered voter population didn't have this sort of ID. Even if you use that as the measure, that's still nationwide many hundreds of thousands of people times the rate at which we understand in-person voter fraud happens, people pretending to be somebody else. That is to say, the cure, quote-unquote, is hundreds of thousands of times worse than the purported disease.
I guess this leads me to another question. So the Supreme Court suggested in Crawford v. Marion County Election Board that voter ID laws were okay if they had the object of increasing public confidence in elections and presented a limited burden to voters. So we've seen now that they clearly do have a tremendous burden on voters. So that leaves me two questions. A, are these voter ID laws actually increasing public confidence in our election system? And B, let's look into the future. Do you think the Supreme Court is going to have to revisit this issue?
So take your first question first. Again, there's no evidence. People say that ID laws and other limitations will increase people's confidence in the election system. Of course, that's a two-sided coin, right? If you know somebody who hasn't been able to vote because of an ID rule, you're going to be less confident in the system. So it doesn't only work in one direction. The only available data that I've seen on this is from a very careful study by Professors Nate Persley and Stephen Salabaher, published in the Harvard Law Review not that long ago, that actually measured people's confidence in the election system, including a whole bunch of questions on voter fraud and people's confidence about whether their vote had been counted accurately and whether they thought the elections were fair and like, and tried to match that up with states with increasingly restrictive ID laws. What they found is no real correlation. It turns out that if you believe the elections have been stolen, you're going to believe the elections are stolen really no matter what the underlying rules are. And if you don't believe the elections are stolen, you're going to continue to have faith in the elections no matter what the underlying rules are. So I hear the argument, but the only actual information we have, the only actual data we have, suggests that it's not really increasing public confidence in any sort of measurable way.
So how do we change public perception and, I suppose, more importantly, the Supreme Court's mind on this?
Well, I'm not sure. So the courts have traditionally been very deferential to states in regulating their election laws, in part because we really do need regulation in order to make elections work. There has to be a time to cast ballots. There has to be a time when you can no longer cast ballots. There have to be safeguards in place to make sure that eligible people are casting ballots and that ineligible people aren't. And all of that means that legislatures do have a variety of ways to govern the system. And that is, I think, as it should be. Legislatures really should be experimenting with different means of providing access to the franchise and in securing the franchise. I think that it's unlikely that the Supreme Court will revisit this issue in particular in the near future. For those that are skeptical of the court's either ability or willingness to strike down overly burdensome regulations, I think that may not be a bad thing that another case doesn't come up to the court for a while. There are other lower courts, there are state courts, that are right now working through, given the records we have, how these ID laws function and whether, in fact, the burden that they impose is constitutionally improper under either the federal or the state constitutions.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about voter IDs, but I know you're also very concerned about other restrictions on the franchise, including voter registration and limitations on early voting. So I don't know if you can give an overview of these sorts of restrictions and, you know, whether there are any benefits that come from, you know, I know you've said regulations are necessary, but, you know, what sort of benefits come from restricting early voting or voter registration drives?
Right. So here, too, we've seen an upshot over the last few years of restrictions where the costs seem to outweigh the benefits and not by a little bit. I'll unfortunately single out Florida, which seems to get itself singled out every presidential election season, because it passed a number of laws over the last couple of years. One of the laws affects both registration and early voting, and it's one of the ones where the balance of costs and benefits just doesn't add up. So before a few years ago, Florida had a system where county supervisors, local election officials, had to offer early voting on the weekend, 8 hours over the course of the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and local election administrators had the discretion to decide when to offer that. Florida passed a new law restricting the total amount of early voting time, but also, and I think crucially, prohibiting election administrators from opening the polls on the Sunday before the election. That doesn't have an awful lot of benefit for local election administrators if it wasn't cost effective to offer voting on the Sunday before the election beforehand. They just didn't offer it. If it was cost effective, or if it provided a service that their constituents wanted, they did offer it. And the new Florida law prohibits them from offering something they were free to offer in 2008 that actually relieved a lot of congestion on election day at the polls. That's on the cost side. So to me, that makes no sense whatsoever. It deprives local election officials of flexibility. Closing on the Sunday before election day is not a coincidence. So on Sunday, particularly in traditional minority communities, many churches encouraged their faithful flock to go to the polls after they went to church. So there were souls to the polls drives encouraging citizens, eligible citizens, to fulfill their civic obligations after they were done fulfilling their spiritual ones. And
well, I know that this was justified on the one of the local legislators that said, well, we just don't want to mix politics and religion.
You're not mixing politics and religion by making the polls available when people want to be there. And to the contrast, if you know that traditionally, particularly in minority communities, minority faithful have gone from the churches to the polls, and you close down the polls without another valid reason, it does make you wonder whether that was a deliberate attempt to close down the polls in order to impede this particular mobilization. Now, there's been no proof of that, but it raises an awful lot of questions when there's no other valid reason to make the change. And this is true, by the way, in the registration context as well. We've seen cutbacks on assisting third parties assisting in registration. Unfortunately, we have a registration system that is still stuck very much in the 19th century. It's still very much based on people submitting written things on paper. In order to make sure that more Americans are participating in their own government, we really need third-party organizations to help make sure that people are on the rolls, to encourage people to get registered, to help them when they do.
Well, if states don't seem to trust these citizen voter registration drives, what can states do to make it easier for their citizens to register?
There are lots of ways for states to take some affirmative steps. And some states, by the way, should reward them, have done so. Some states have allowed for online registration, generally restricted, and again, we have a problem here, to individuals with a driver's license or state ID. You put in your driver's license number, you can register online. A few states have experimented with that and have found not only enormous cost savings. Arizona has found an enormously dramatic cost savings. But also, it smooths the process out. Here, too, it stops registrations all from coming in on the last day. People register more consistently, more evenly over the course of an election cycle. To really ramp that up, states could certainly draw from other government services, not just the DMV. For example, those getting government assistance have to already prove their citizenship in order to get federal government assistance. That's one of the new policies the government's passed in the last decade. Well, those people are all citizens, some of whom are registered, some of whom are not. There's already a requirement under the National Voter Registration Act, under Motor Voter, massively under-enforced, to make registration forms available to people who come in for government assistance. But states could do the same thing with affirmative outreach, either in making that available online or in drawing from the existing lists in order to affirmatively and proactively get people registered. It would be a way of modernizing our voter registration system, bringing it into the 21st century by using some of the 21st century infrastructure we have, rather than depending on repeat submissions of pieces of paper which get lost, which have typos, which spike right the 30 days before election day, creating an awful lot of hassle for administrators and an awful lot of incremental staff time.
One other topic that we should definitely talk about is sort of voter purges. That's been in the news all the time recently. When are voter purges appropriate, and how can they best be done, and what's going on with voter purges right now?
Cleaning the rolls, maintaining the rolls is useful, but the problem shows up when purges are done based on sloppy information or hastily. There's a restriction in, again, the Motor Voter Act, the National Voter Registration Act, that basically says you can clean the rolls using reliable sources up to 90 days before an election, but 90 days before an election, pencils down. The 90-day pencils down period is meant to say, clean the rolls and make sure they're clean. But because we're worried that there might be mistakes, you got to stop at a certain point. These mistakes that we're worried about arise for a number of different reasons, including, most prominently, bad matches of faulty data. You see this most often about sort of reports of dead voters done by taking the registration rolls and comparing them to Social Security death lists. Every time one of these studies is done, you see, and every time there's actual follow-up, you see people who they claim are dead who aren't dead, people who they claim voted who didn't actually vote, or people who aren't the same people. So many people assume, and the way these matches are most commonly done is by matching up a name and a birth date. So John Smith, born on June 1st, matches John Smith, born on June 1st, must be the same person. If they're marked as dead here, then I should take them off the rolls.
Makes sense to me.
It makes sense to most people intuitively, but statistics gives us a surprise. So most people don't realize if you put a bunch of people in a room and you say, how many of them have the same birthday? When would you expect that, for example, two people in the room would have the same month and day of birth?
I remember from grade school, it's pretty high.
It's pretty high. The number of matches you get are pretty high, and the number of people you have in the room is pretty low. So most people say, well, if you had, 180 people in a room, you'd expect maybe the two of them would have the same birthday. The chances would be over 50%. Turns out the number's 23. If you have 23 people in a room, and this has been proven over and over again by lots of statistics professors making a lot of money off bets with their students, you have 23 people in the room, chances are better than 50-50 that two of them will share the same month and day of birth. By the time you expand that to year, you do the same statistics, you end up with about 190, 200 people in the room. And by the time you get to 400 people in the room, it's almost certain that two of them will share the same month, day, and year of birth, that they'll have the same birth date. Why do I mention any of this? Because when you have big pools of names like registration lists or big pools of names like death lists for the country, and you have rooms of people with the same name, John Smith, John Williams, Maria Rodriguez, then you only need 400 Maria Rodriguez's to be sure that two of them will share the same birth date.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got pools of millions of people on each list, you are guaranteed to be mistakenly assuming that Maria Rodriguez on one list is the same person as Maria Rodriguez on the other list, when really they just share the same birth date and they're not the same people. There was one very famous news conference where Secretary of State Chris Kobach from Kansas pointed to dead voters and the fact that there was voter fraud occurring. And we know this because this one individual had died and then voted. A reporter actually went and checked in on the dead voter and found him raking leaves, not dead at all. These sorts of mistakes happen all the time. But if you're not careful about how you clean the rolls, then you're kicking out an awful lot of eligible voters in addition to the ones who aren't eligible and probably aren't going to vote anyway.
Now, I also asked Professor Levitt to comment about what our voting process might look like in an ideal world. I thought his answer and his discussion about our fiscal priorities was especially important.
So I am very much both a realist and a pragmatist. I think real data is important. I think understanding limitations are important. I think understanding incremental ways to improve the system we have are very important. And I think all of that will take time to move from where we are now to where we could be. That said, there's a real opportunity for improvement. And in my idealized system, we probably end up spending a whole lot more money nationally on elections than we do. We spend per capita very, 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 very little on our election process, far less than most Western industrialized democracies. In some ways, we get what we pay for. So we are running elections more or less on the cheap, and it shows. A little bit of investment could actually end up saving cost in the long run by improving our system. So first and foremost, the registration system. A third of the country not registered to vote. A third of the eligible American citizens not registered to vote. That means we need big changes in the registration process to really make it accessible for all. And to me, that looks like a 21st century registration system, one that's much more modernized, one that uses far more of our existing technology and our existing record keeping to not only get people registered, but keep them registered, and have a registration system that moves when people move. You know, 14% of the country moves every year, and has to re-register every time they do. My alumni institution and my magazines managed to keep up with me. There's no reason that our registration system couldn't be better. There also need to be, I think, sensible safeguards at the polls and beyond for absentee voting and early voting that target real problems without targeting fake ones. So there are still, we need people to identify that they are who they say they are. There are lots of ways to do that that don't leave eligible Americans out of the process, and 43 states have found them so far. We'd also have a more professionalized, more permanent official force. And by that, I mean not only better pay for election administrators, but also a different system of engaging poll workers that, you know, right now we are awfully dependent on the good wishes of an awful lot of citizens who work very hard, but who are versed in election laws for a few hours before they show up for a single day. There's no other government system that we run, with the sole exception of perhaps the census, that depends so heavily on volunteer time. All of that takes a different approach to the election process, which isn't just getting by with what we have, but thinking about what we affirmatively might do. It's a different orientation. It's thinking about the election process as serving both administrators and voters, rather than simply relying on the system that we've had for a long time without thinking about whether it makes sense or not. In my ideal system, there are pragmatic steps forward to that. And I'll say, my old employer, you mentioned it at the top of the podcast, the Brennan Center for Justice, has done an awful lot of work on real, pragmatic, incremental ways to achieve some of the things that I've just talked about.
As always, theme music is Brass Beat by Covert, available on a Creative Commons license. This episode also featured the campaign jingle, I Like Ike, from the Eisenhower presidential campaign 60 years ago this fall. In the interest of being fair and balanced, to take us away, here's a jingle from Ike's opponent, Adlai Stevenson.